All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Bob Gould.
And good afternoon. Bob Gould here on Veterans Radio, bringing you another program on our military right here from the studios at WAAM in beautiful Ann Arbor, Michigan. This is our flagship station, folks. We are broadcasting around the world. You can listen to Veterans Radio and even get our archives and other little tidbits by going to veteransradio.net. That's right. Be sure you go veteransradio.net. We got a great program today. We're going to be talking with one of our frequent guests, Dr. John McManus. You remember, a historian. He wrote the book September Hope, The True Story of the American Side of a Bridge Too Far. He'll be on later on today. And we also have something from the Louisville Slugger Warriors. Yes, Louisville Slugger Warriors. Oh, I want to hear all about that. And before we do, we got to catch up on a little bit of news. Oh, okay. That's a teletype going, folks. The Vets Returning Home, that's an organization whose mission is helping veterans in crisis and helping them to reclaim their independence. They're having a country concert, and it's part of a series. It begins on September the 15th. That's a concert series. September 15th, it will be at the Royalty House in Warren, Michigan. So you're going to know all about that. Who's going to be the headliners? Joey V and Ray Scott. Ooh, I wonder if that's any relation to Jack Scott. You remember him, folks. People in me. No, anyway, that was Jack Scott. He was right here from Detroit, too. I wonder how many folks know that. Then this will be the first in a series of monthly concerts. So you're being invited to this new event coming up, the concert series on September 15th at the Royalty House in Warren, Michigan. The Vets Returning Home has beds, facilities. They provide a safe alcohol and drug-free program. I like that. They provide meals, job training, counseling, addiction intervention. It's veterans helping veterans, folk. That's real cool, right? So once again, September 15th at the Royalty House in Warren. Hey, why don't you get out? That's going to be in the evening, but you're going to want to go to Vets Returning Home. That's right. VetsReturningHome.com. VetsReturningHome.com. Also, on Sunday, September the 11th, starting at noon, will be the annual Washtenaw County VVA Chapter 310 annual pig roast. Oh boy, that pig sure is good. Nice and moist too. I like that. It's going to be a lot of fun. A lot of veterans. Going to be live music, children's face painting, Huey helicopter. Yeah, Dale will like that one. Huey helicopter, military vehicles, bucket drawings, wonderful item, military merchandise sales, etc., etc. Yeah, there's a slight it's a sawbuck, folks. That's $10 to get all the pork you can eat and all that other delicious stuff that goes along with it. That's at the Washtenaw County VVA Chapter 310, and that's on Wagner Road. If you want the address, 3230 South Wagner Road in Ann Arbor, Michigan. It's part of the VFW Post 423. So that's September the 11th, noon until 4 o'clock at the annual pig roast of Washtenaw County VVA Chapter 310. We'll be right back right after this very important message. And we're back on Veterans Radio. Our next guests, yes, guests, are with the Louisville Slugger Warriors. And you don't say Louisville. I was stationed at Fort Knox. What do you all say? Yeah, I know. All the guys are shaking their heads. That went to Fort Knox for basic training. You say Louisville. You say Louisville. Well, guess what? You're in big trouble down there. So with Louisville Slugger Warriors, what are these guys? Well, they're going to be playing in Utica, Michigan this coming, in remembrance of 9/11. And that's going to be Saturday, September 10th. Okay, at the Jimmy Johns Field in Utica, Michigan. And to tell us all about this is the general manager, David Van Sleet. David, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Bob. It's a pleasure to be on the show this afternoon.
And how are things in Bonita Springs?
It's beautiful down here. Yeah, the sun is shining like it always does.
And did all that rain and wind pass you by?
Yeah, we really didn't experience much of it because it headed north, north of Tampa and the Panhandle. But we got a little bit of rain, a little bit of wind, but nothing that we weren't used to.
Whew, you ducked a big one. I was at Hurricane Francis. I know what it's like to be in a hurricane. Well, David is the general manager of a men's slow pitch softball team, the Louisville Sluggers. He is the general manager. It's a highly competitive softball tournament team. Yes, the Louisville Slugger. They're Louisville Slugger Warriors. I want to get that right. And David, in 1996, was selected and honored as the VA prosthetic. I got to get this right. Prosthetic chief of the year. He was chief of prosthetics for over 30 years in the VA. In 2011, David was awarded the VA's highest award, the prestigious Olin E. Teague Award, that recognizes an employee with the VA whose achievements have been extraordinarily beneficial to the rehabilitation of war-injured veterans. I like that. And again, in 2013, the Military Order of the Purple Heart presented its highest award, the George Washington Medallion of Merit Award, to Mr. Van Sleet for his extraordinary service to our country and its veterans. David is a U.S. Army veteran, I like that too, who served in the Vietnam era and now resides in Bonita Beach, Florida. Once again, welcome, David.
Thank you very much, Bob. It's going to be a pleasure to come up to Michigan this coming weekend.
Now, tell us all about this Louisville Slugger Warriors, and by the way, folks, we are no longer using the word handicap. Got it? It's called handy-capable. Isn't that right, David?
Yeah, these guys have exceeded their rehabilitation and train on a daily basis, so you really don't need to use the word handicap or disabled among these guys.
Tell us all about the Louisville Warriors.
Yeah, these guys have all served in the military, and most of them in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they've all suffered some type of wound, whether it be physical or whether it be invisible. Our physical wounds stand out immensely because we have 8 amputees on this team, and they have figured out the game very, very well, playing with a prosthetic device. And they were always good athletes, you know, in high school and playing in the service before they got hurt. But once they got hurt, they went through extensive rehabilitation. And with the state-of-the-art prosthetic technology that's out there now, these guys are playing tournaments all over the country and entering just as a regular team and playing against able-bodied teams, and they're holding their own.
Okay. Now, tell us a little bit about what this, you play all year round, correct? That's what I'm going for, right?
Yes, that is correct.
So it's highly competitive.
Yes, and you know, that's what we wanted. These guys have been training for, you know, even up to 5 years, and now that they've gotten proficient, they don't want to be known as an amputee or someone suffering from an invisible wound. They want to play mainstream men's tournament softball, and that's exactly what they're doing.
And they can really smack that ball?
Well, they can hit it, they can field it, they can throw it. They're doing everything they're supposed to be doing.
Now, if someone wants to find more information on the Louisville Slugger Warriors, what's that website?
Well, we go with just Facebook. We figured out Facebook is just the main social media source these days, and unless you're a big company hiring people and stuff, the website doesn't come into play as much anymore. So we go with Louisville Slugger Warriors Facebook, and we get the word out and get to our audience and the sports world that way now.
Yeah, I've looked at and tell our listeners, how do you folks who manufactures it has to be specialized equipment. Who manufactures this for you?
Well, there's a couple of big prosthetic companies in the country now that have assisted in making, these special devices for us. And there's even a special prosthetist out in the Seattle area that specializes high-end athletes that are amputees. And so a lot of our guys are sent out there to Greg Davidson, a prosthetist out in Puyallup, Washington. But a lot of it's, it's adaptable just wherever they're at around the country as well. We are very, very well supplied with the top equipment in the sports world and softball world by Louisville Slugger. So between the prosthetist and Louisville Slugger's equipment, they figured out how to fine-tune a lot of this stuff.
Now, you've been with these Sluggers for how long?
Well, I've been with the team for most of these guys for over 5 years. But this past March, we took the top amputees in the country that wanted to play softball at a national tournament level and travel once or twice a month. And that's what we've been doing. So we've been on the road, every month since March, playing in national tournaments. In fact, we just got back from Augusta, Georgia, at the World Military Softball Tournament. We fared very well. We won 3 and lost 2. But you got to remember, we got a team of a lot of physical injuries here playing against mainstream and able-bodied teams. But we're doing well. We're doing well.
Who sponsors? Of course, the government.
We got some big sponsors.
I guess my question is, do you get any money from the government?
All these guys that are service connected are getting compensated. They are getting compensated based on the level of their disability. So some of them are getting very large checks each month. Some are getting smaller ones based on the level of their disability. But as far as sponsorship from the government, we don't get that.
Now, American House is going to be the sponsor of the event in Utica. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, American House, we can't say enough about them. They have a very strong prominence and presence in the Detroit area, I think, with over 40 senior-assisted living communities. But the founder, Bob Gillette, lives down in Bonita Springs, Florida, and I became associated with him down here as he sponsored a couple events for our guys down here. And then the relationship got closer and closer, and now him and his wife are friends with my parents, and they live right across the street from each other. Their development's right across the street from the other development. And then Bob is a true advocate of, supporting veterans and being a veteran himself. And he's taken it to the next level with his company. And, he's still on the board of directors, but his company has been fantastic. We've been working with the staff for months to promote this event this coming Saturday. But American House is literally one of our top sponsors and has been very, very generous. And now they're rolling out the red carpet hospitality-wise this coming weekend.
Where does your team, where is their home base? Do you folks have a home base or something we all kind of?
Not necessarily. Our team has been hand-selected by the coaches, and these guys live all throughout the country. A couple of them live near each other, and they play in leagues and go out and practice together during the week. But when we converge on a city like Detroit this coming weekend, we're flying in from almost 12 to 15 different locations and meeting at the airport and moving out from there. So we do not live together. It's a hand-selected team by the coaches, and, they're very good at, organizing this whole thing and converging on a city and moving out.
Okay, Dave, hold it right there. Right now, folks, we're going to have one of these Louisville Slugger Warriors, Leonard Anderson. Leonard Anderson was in the Afghan theater in the Air Force, and he right now resides in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Leonard, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Okay. What position do you play?
I mainly just hit now. I'm kind of the EH, but I can pitch a little bit as well.
So you play first base and pitch?
No. I EH, extra hitter.
Oh, okay. All right.
So I mainly just hit.
And when did you join the team?
Well, I originally got with Dave. I think it's been about 3 years now. And then once this kind of, you know, formed into what it has become, you know, I got on board with this immediately and been with him ever since. So I've been with the team now for the whole year that we've been together.
What's the most important thing that you've accomplished?
On the field, I think it gave you that competitive edge back to something to work for, because me playing before I was injured and then seeing guys playing now, I want to not be considered an amputee. I want to hit on the same level they do. So the fact that I have at some periods of time, you know, shows that the drive and the ambition is paying off.
And physically, are you doing extra rehab to be in condition for this particular for this play? Are you doing rehab?
I mean, I just do what I did before. You know, it's just a lot of practice, a lot of BP. I got a lot of friends up here that I take a lot of cuts with, and you know, a lot of it, just like any other sport, is just get out there and play it. I mean, that's the biggest thing. We go to the gym and do things like that when, you know, in our off time and when we have time to get there, and we try to eat the right things and do all the right things, but we're also grown men. So, you know, we like to have fun and kick a few back. So we have a good time, but mainly it's about the focus on the field. So
now tell us a little bit, tell our audience a little bit about what they're going to see when they go to Utica. What are they going to see when you folks take the field?
Well, I just think you're going to see, you know, what someone with an injury overcoming adversity, you know, has to offer. I think we kind of let our play speak for ourselves as far as what you get out of it. We don't try to sway you for one way or the other. What you get is what you get. It may be something, you know, as far as depression that you're trying to overcome, or it may be something as far as a physical limitation that you're trying to overcome. Then we're just hoping that by watching us and seeing the things that we can do with the limitations that we have, inspires you to kind of go and do the same thing with your life and compete at the highest level possible and never settle for just a, you know, mediocrity. Still try to find that drive that gets you to the top.
Are you planning on sticking this thing out all the way for months and months and months?
I'm sorry?
Is this something that's going to now become part of your life?
Oh, it's already been a part of my life. It's been a big part of my life ever since I was young, all the way up to when I started my career, all the way up through my injury, and it's, you know, probably saved my life after the injury. So, yeah, I will never walk away from this sport until I can't play it anymore, and then I'll probably coach it if I can.
Well, I like that. Hang on for a second there. Leonard, let's get back with David. David, if you had something to say to our audience, what would you say right now?
Well, first of all, you just heard from Leonard, and, you know, Leonard's quite humble, and of all the players on the team, he probably impresses me the most of what he's working with and what he can do. So the audience, if you get a chance to come see this team play, Leonard lost his lower left arm below his elbow, and he has two fingers on his right hand, and he can hit with the best of them. I think the highlight of this year, when I saw him hit one out in Oklahoma, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, hit one out of the park, and being, you know, a serious amputee and having that kind of strength to still hit at that level amazes me, and I can only imagine what it amazes to the audience. But, you know, this is a special occasion. If you've got nothing going on this coming Saturday, in case you don't know, it's the 15th anniversary of 9/11 this coming weekend, with Sunday being the 11th. Some of these guys joined the service because of, you know, the attack on our Twin Towers. Some of them were maybe just ahead of that. But these guys all served in the military, Iraq, Afghanistan, and they gave up everything to defend our country. So, you know, it's going to be a special occasion. It's going to be a very competitive game. We're playing a very good team called the Detroit Connection, and, you know, they're all able bodies. So, you know, we're going to have to work our tail off to keep up with them. But I feel very confident that we can hold our own and give the audience, you know, a good show.
Okay, folks, that's going to be in Utica, Michigan at the Jimmy Johns Field on Auburn Road, Utica, Michigan. That's Saturday, September the 10th. It starts at 1 o'clock. Yeah, there's a slight admission. $5. Everybody's got $5. And how about veterans? Are you expecting a lot of veterans there?
Well, I know the American House PR and Marketing and Publicity Department has put a lot out, and I know that American House has a lot of senior type veterans living in their communities that if they're well enough, they're going to be bringing them to the game. But, you know, we want a lot of people in that stadium, both non-veterans and veterans, and just supporting the cause and coming out to see us play.
I like that. David, thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio. Leonard, thank you very much also for being on Veterans Radio. And get 4 for $4. This coming Saturday, Leonard, I want to see. Leonard, you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
There. Okay, I want you to go 4 for $4, okay? That's on the I got that, 4 for $4. I'm writing that down. And I'm going to be out there watching you boys, so I'll see you all out there. David, thank you again. Leonard, thank you again. And please
thank
come back.
So
we'll have you back on the program again.
Okay, thank
all
you,
right.
Bob.
Take care. All right. Wow. Boy, that's pretty exciting stuff. Veterans helping veterans. Yeah, we got 5 minutes. Our screener, Nina, gives me the hand sign there, shows me the five fingers. That must mean five, right? Or $5. Well, that's the cost if they're, that's right. To go see these guys play. But right now, on the Veterans Radio, on the line with me is Russell Levine. Russell, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks, Bob. Thank you very much for having me on.
And Russell is the vice president of the Michigan World War II Legacy Memorial. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago. There's a statue that they're, well, tell us all about that.
Sure. So the Michigan World War II Legacy Memorial is Michigan's official tribute to its contributions during World War II. Not only the 600,000 folks who men and women who served in the armed forces, but also all the folks that worked on the home front keeping the arsenal of democracy ticking. And, of course, we were the birthplace of Rosie the Riveter. So we're building the memorial in Memorial Park in Royal Oak, Michigan. We've got a $3 million fundraising goal. And to draw attention to that, we brought in, as you mentioned, the giant statue of the sailor and nurse kissing. We're hoping that the folks who have the funds and are interested in helping us will find that hard to miss. And then we'll ask what's going on. And then we'll help us with our ultimate goal.
Now, you're building a statue of the famous kiss, the kiss on Times Square.
The statue is there already of the famous kiss. We borrowed that. We have that for 6 months, and that will draw attention to the fact that we're building a complete memorial that will take up approximately 3/4 acre in the park.
How tall will that statue be?
Well, the statue is already there, and it's a 25-foot statue, and that will be there for 6 months. It's pretty spectacular, but once the memorial is built, it's going to be even more spectacular, so we're very excited about that.
And the statue depicts the famous kiss, and it took years to identify who they were. Tell us about the kiss.
Right, so the kiss took place at the end of World War II in Times Square in New York. And what happened was there was such jubilation and celebration that people were hugging and kissing. There was a famous photograph that took place there, and that was the basis. It appeared in Time magazine and the New York Times, and that was the basis of the statue that was created.
Now, I consider that iconic, the kiss. It meant so much. It was a sailor who was walking down Times Square, and he just grabbed this nurse walking in the other direction and gave her a big smack after pulling her down by the small of her back. It represented so much of what it was. It was just like the flag raising at Iwo Jima, the kiss. Yeah. Did they ever identify who these were?
Well, they have a pretty good idea of who they were based on some recent evidence of who else was in the background of the picture. And the great thing about the statue is it's also going to draw attention to the gala that we're having. We're having a big gala in this, not too far from where the kiss is, also in the city of Royal Oak at the farmer's market there on October 13th at 6:30 p.m. We're really excited. We're going to have John Tigan, who is one of the gentlemen who rescued the folks in the embassy in Benghazi and co-wrote the book 13 hours. We're going to have Guy, he'll be speaking. We're going to have Guy Gordon be the host. We're going to have a strolling dinner. We're going to have live music. We're going to have auction, military vehicles, reenactors. It's going to be great.
Now, this is at Royal Oak, right?
It's in Royal Oak, the Royal Oak Farmers Market, and people can go to thevictorygala.org and find out how to buy tickets. They're $100 for general admission, $150 for VIP. That'll be an hour earlier at 5:30, where you can meet John, get a picture with him. And that's kind of a very special opportunity that people will have. So we're really encouraging people to go out and buy tickets now at thevictorygala.org. You can buy an entire table so you can ensure seating, business attire or service dress uniforms. It's an enclosed and heated facility, so you don't have to worry about it being a farmer's market. It's a place where they hold weddings. It's a pretty snazzy place when they dress it up.
Now, that once again, Royal Oak, Michigan, October 13th at 6:30. What if you get a VIP ticket? What else do you get besides meeting some of the folks? What else?
Sure. Well, you get to meet John. You get to mingle with him. We're going to have appetizers and special food for that. We're going to have copies of his book there for those folks as well. And it's just a quiet time. Once general admission happens at 6:30, it's going to be a pretty exciting and busy place.
Okay.
So it's a chance for people to get in early and get in some get in some time to get an advanced look at some of our silent auction items.
Thank you, Russell. We got to go. We're getting right to the news. Thank you for being. We'll be right back. You're listening to Veterans Radio. Okay, we're back on Veterans Radio. Right now, one of our frequent guests, Professor John McManus, is on with us today. He wrote the book, September Hope. And we're going to, well, what a better time to do it during September. John, welcome to Veterans Radio again.
Hey, Bob, how are you?
Well, we're doing all right. The AC's out, but we're still doing okay here. How are things down there where you are?
Doing great. No complaints at all.
Are you expecting any rain from the hurricane?
No, that usually dissipates by the time it gets to us. So we've got beautiful weather here, actually.
John McManus is a full professor of U.S. military history at Missouri University of Science and Technology. John teaches a course on World War II and modern American combat experience. John, you wrote September Hope. We're in September. Tell us all about that.
Yeah, September Hope is about what's called Operation Market Garden. We just sort of, in popular culture, tend to call it A Bridge Too Far after the classic movie and the book by Cornelius Ryan, which is truly one of the great books on World War II, in my view. And basically what that was, the Allies attempted after the Battle of Normandy, when they really had Germany on the run and they felt that it was on the verge of collapse, the Allies attempted a joint airborne armor operation to capture key bridges in Holland so they could get into northern Germany and then knife on the way to Berlin and hopefully end the war, kind of collapse the Hitler regime. Unfortunately, it didn't work out that way, and the campaign ended up as a real disaster. And there were two U.S. airborne divisions involved in it, the famous 82nd and the 101st. And so my book focuses on the American experience in the battle alongside their British allies of what the fighting was like, during those frenetic days in September 1944, and then subsequently when they end up in this kind of stalemate campaign to hang on to the portions of Holland they had liberated, in the face of German counterattacks.
Now, folks, let me give you a little bit of history. This was right after D-Day, and we're all waiting for Monty to capture Kahn. He was not able to do diddly squat with Kahn. Here comes Patton. He's now got to go south. He's got to go around Kahn. They've been waiting for Kahn to get open. They even bombed the darn thing. Only thing that made was a whole bunch of strongholds for the Germans. So that was a big mistake. But Monty finally breaks out. And in the meantime, Patton is moving ahead. He wants to go to Germany. He takes Metz. Why was Metz important?
Well, Metz is important because it's one of the key transit points over the Rhine River and thus into western Germany. It also, the approaches to Metz were heavily fortified in what's called the Siegfried Line or the West Wall. It was a belt of fortifications that Hitler had ordered built in the late 1930s that he hoped would guard the German frontier in the event that France ever invaded or there'd be any sort of threat to Germany from the western side. And so, Patton feels that really sort of the midsection of Germany from Metz eastward is the key to collapsing Nazi Germany. But he kind of feels that conveniently in the sense that that's where his armies happened to be in September 1944. Montgomery and the British and Canadians were farther to the north, closer to the English Channel in Belgium, Holland, and closer to northern Germany, which really was more of a direct route to Berlin. And of course, Eisenhower has other armies just sort of going shoulder to shoulder, advancing eastward as you get towards the end of August into early September. So really the key problem he's dealing with now is one of supply. The farther you get from Normandy, the harder it is to keep all your armies operating logistically. And so he's having to make tough choices, and that's really, in a way, what dictates everything from September onward.
John, here's Patton going 50 miles a day. He's moving, and he's halted. He's told to stop. He's ready to go into Germany to make that. What happened? Eisenhower goes, no. He gives his supplies. Well, who did he give the supplies to?
Well, Eisenhower, doesn't have enough supplies to sustain all of these armies that are approaching the German frontier. And so he's got his two contentious subordinates who, as you know, are deep rivals, Montgomery and Patton, both arguing for priority supply, saying they hold the key to entering Germany and conquering it. So both of them want, ironically enough, in a way, the same thing, what's called a single thrust into Germany, which was very risky. And probably because the Germans weren't near collapse, would have invited some significant counterattacks to destroy that single thrust, and Market Garden is something of the proof of it. Patton, of course, wants priority as well, but it's likely the same thing is probably going to happen to him. Eisenhower favors what's called a broad front strategy, which is let's go at a slower, more deliberate pace, let's make sure we can supply and sustain everybody, and let's advance on a broad line and overwhelm manpower and firepower and the like. And that's really, Eisenhower's concept is really quite similar to what President Lincoln and General Grant did to the Confederacy in the Civil War. So it's a kind of American tradition in this sense, but Eisenhower decides to diverge from that in giving Montgomery, priority for Market Garden for these airborne drops. And he doesn't quite realize what that decision is going to mean for the Allied war effort, unfortunately.
Now, how much was Eisenhower brought in by Montgomery with all this strategy?
Well, Eisenhower and Montgomery, had been out of touch with each other in terms of face-to-face contact for many weeks by the late summer 1944 as the Allied armies advanced so quickly. And they finally meet on the tarmac inside of Eisenhower's plane and the Brussels airport on September 10th, 1944. And it's at this meeting that Montgomery sells him on this concept of, hey, let's drop our three airborne divisions, one British and two U.S., in behind the German lines in Holland. Let's capture key bridges over the major river systems, and then we'll run armor through to link up with these paratroopers. We'll get into northern Germany and make trouble there. And Eisenhower, this appeals to him because he likes the idea of having just a bridgehead over the Rhine, from which he can exploit later. What he doesn't understand is when he gives the go-ahead for this operation, he's essentially giving priority to Montgomery for that single thrust, and certainly at the expense of Patton, but also in a larger sense, Bradley's armies, because Patton's under Bradley. He's got multiple U.S. armies that are going to be impoverished logistically because of this. So really, I would say if we're to assign blame ultimately for Market Garden, it's Eisenhower in a way who should get the large portion of it because he's the guy who gives the go-ahead for it, and he really didn't have to. And I think it's one of his few poor decisions during the campaign in Europe.
Now, here's Patton, been told to halt. Well, I'm sure he went and lit a cigar, put his feet up on the table, and waited. Is that true? What was he like?
Patton, of course, is very mercurial, very colorful, and certainly the kind of guy who likes to sustain the momentum of operations. He's an offensive thinker, and he's a glory hound, just like his opposite Montgomery. They approach their operations differently in the sense that Montgomery's, of course, much more deliberate, Patton a bit more of a risk taker. So, Patton, I don't think there's any question. One of the reasons he wants priority to knife through Metz and into central Germany is so that he has the leading role, just as Montgomery wants the same thing to the north. And so Eisenhower is having to balance all this and try and decide what's best for the Allied cause as a whole. So it leads to some significant frustration for our friend Patton because certainly he favors mechanized operations and the tanks and the armored personnel carriers, all that kind of stuff, mobile mechanized warfare. Well, you need fuel for that. And you know, they're just not able to get him enough fuel to sustain any kind of significant momentum. Of course, he's not the only one. So, you know, you can see this in the larger context that Patton is just one of several high-ranking Allied commanders who just aren't getting enough to keep moving as of September of 44.
Now, Eisenhower, of course, he bumped this up to Marshall. What did Marshall think about Montgomery's plan and the fact that Patton was halted? Did he have any comment on that? What did he say?
Marshall, you know, tries to stay out of this idea of evaluating a, you know, an Allied colleague in the sense of Montgomery. Now, certainly Marshall is going to support whatever Eisenhower does. So Eisenhower doesn't really go to Marshall for approval of his decision-making. What he does is he reports on his decision-making, why he's done what he's done. He writes rather fascinating letters to Marshall. And if we look at Marshall's commentary, you know, later on after the war, Marshall certainly agrees with what Eisenhower favors in terms of that broad front. And I think if we were to ask Marshall in a candid moment, do you think Market Garden should have gone forward, he would probably tell us no. Montgomery, to his credit, will take some responsibility for the failure of the operation, but he will always say to his dying day, you know, if they'd given me exactly what I asked for and what I really needed, Market Garden could have succeeded in spite of my mistakes. So it was classic Montgomery in the sense of he sort of admits his own failings in this rare occasion, but also bucks up the ultimate responsibility elsewhere, saying he didn't get enough support. Well, Eisenhower gave him everything he could have. Problem is, you just don't have enough stuff.
Well, yeah, and I consider all Montgomery talking about he didn't have, that to me sounds like second guessing on that. That's a lot of horse muffins as far as I look at. Right. But,
sure.
But horse muffins, we know what those are, folks, yes. But getting back to, all right, so Montgomery gets this, oh, he must be happier than a tea party at Parliament. And now he's got that. How many men were involved in Market Garden?
Yeah, quite a few. You had about 60,000 airborne and glider troops who are going to be put down in what one of the planners called an airborne carpet. So anywhere from, say, Eindhoven, which is about 15 miles behind the German lines, to ultimately, of course, Arnhem, which is the famous bridge too far over the Rhine, that's about 58 to 60 miles behind the line. So each of these airborne divisions represents, you know, anywhere from about 9 to 14,000 soldiers. And, of course, you're going to have then follow-on forces that come in, some of them via glider, some of them via transport aircraft, to bring in, you know, artillery and shells and food and, you know, resupply. Now, they're going to be linked up with the airborne force, which is the armored force, which is British 30 Corps. So now you're talking about probably, you know, doubling the size of my original number there. So we're well into six figures now, over 100,000 Allied soldiers. And what they don't realize is there's a couple of fairly powerful German armor divisions, SS armor divisions, near the drop zones in the towns of Nijmegen and Arnhem, which cause a lot of trouble. And the Germans get their act together to scrape together almost everybody they've got in the area to counterattack. And so most of your troops and your tanks and other vehicles are strung out along that road that leads from the jump-off point on the Belgian-Dutch border all the way up to Arnhem. So you're really vulnerable to counterattacks on both sides. The Americans come to call that road Hell's Highway, and it's very aptly named.
Well, I could think, if here we have this big buildup going, how many roads could they go down? Here it was, to me, they were already found out. There had to be people there in Belgium that were reporting all this and sending that back to Germany. Is that true? Did they know all about this thing taking place ahead of time?
The Germans didn't. They were really taken off guard by the airborne landings and this whole operation. They react to it very well. They capture some of the operational orders, not like the whole plan as is portrayed in the movie Bridge Too Far. That's kind of oversimplified. But within about 2 to 3 days, they have a pretty good sense of what the Allies are after. And, you know, one of the things you mentioned, I think it's a really good point. On the Allied side, there's a lot of intelligence about the area, about the terrain, about some of the German units there that's been fed to the Allies by the Dutch resistance, which has a key role in this whole drama. The Dutch side of it is one side that I cover in September Hope that I just found fascinating. And so there's a famous scene, again, to talk about the movie Bridge Too Far, which Michael Caine's character, he's an armor commander, talks about the road that they're on and just how bad it is for the kind of operation you're talking about here. So it's a narrow road, sometimes with embankments on either side. You can't have any mobility of any kind. So you're almost restricted to these kind of narrow paved roads that snake through small towns and choke points for about a 60-mile span. So, you know, to me, when you look at the whole idea of Market Garden, it's based on hope, and that's one of the reasons why I called the book September Hope, because this is hope. This whole thing is kind of predicated on hope that everything will go right, that zero defect, that the Germans are about to just collapse, that they'll be stunned, and that everything will work out somehow. And unfortunately, you know, that's not what happened. So September Hope, to me, seemed to be the perfect thing to call this whole fiasco.
Okay, we're going to stop right there and get a quick message. John, get yourself a catch your breath, and we'll be right back right after this short message with John McManus. And we're back on Veterans Radio. Bob Gould here with Dr. John McManus, author of September Hope, the American side of A Bridge Too Far. Okay, the jumping off point, they're ready to go. They get started. No, but they didn't know about that SS division. Why was that? What happened?
Yeah, you've got the SS 9th and 10th Armored Divisions located near the drop zones at Nijmegen, which is close to where the 82nd Airborne is going to come down. And up near Arnhem, where the British 1st Airborne Division is going to land, there were photo reconnaissance images of a lot of these vehicles that the Allies had. And so the planners knew this ahead of time, but these were understrength divisions that were refitting. They'd really been beat up elsewhere in fighting fronts. And so you see this kind of disconnect of saying, well, we've got the photos of some of these vehicles, but we don't know what that really means. We don't necessarily know what their state of readiness is, nothing like that, but we know they're there. And so there's a kind of willful ignorance side to this, too, but there's no way you could know precisely what the German capabilities are until you're actually there, unfortunately. So, you know, as I said, the Germans are taken completely by surprise. The initial weather is wonderful, beautiful, clear weather, perfect for airborne drops, and it's the first major daylight drop that the Germans or the Allies had in the European theater. So everyone lands okay. The problem is what happens after you land. So in the book, I have, you know, there's a lot of concentration on the experiences of individual American soldiers in all these little towns and burgs and capturing the key bridges and fighting for Nijmegen against the German opposition that boils over within about 48 hours or so as the Germans react. And certainly the SS divisions are kind of the crux of the resistance, especially the closer you get to the built-up areas in Nijmegen and Arnhem. So you end up with some pretty vicious urban combat that goes on over the course of several days.
Now, you wrote this book, September Hope. And by the way, folks, we've got, I know Christmas is still 4 months away, but gee, you could start ordering right now, you know, hide the thing in the closet or something. September, who is the publisher? I'm looking here. Who is the publisher?
Yeah, the publisher is NAL Penguin.
Okay, and you have a website, John, that folks can go to?
Yeah, my website is www.johncmcmanus.com, and you can order September Hope and my other books through there as well. And, of course, Amazon.com, all the other e-tailers, and Barnes & Noble. September Hope is available primarily now in oversized paperback and also electronic format as well.
Yeah, that's what I've got. I have the large paperback right in front of me. Okay, so now we got A Bridge Too Far. The airborne's been dropped. The gliders are down, and the armor's moving up, and they're going. What happened?
Yeah, you have each of these lead armored formations over time start to link up with small groups of airborne soldiers. So this initially happens at Eindhoven, where the 101st Airborne had landed. Although they eventually are behind schedule by about 36 hours because the Germans blow a bridge at a town called Sun, which has a key bridge over a canal that the Allies had to have, and there was no problem getting infantry across that small canal, but vehicles were another matter. So it takes the engineers about 36 hours to rebuild a bridge and get the vehicle traffic running again, and that's time you don't have, you know, because the Germans are reacting and they're starting to fight against either side of the corridor. They've gotten into Nijmegen, and so, you know, it's about two full days before The lead British tanks are able to hook up with the 82nd Airborne near and around Nijmegen, which is about, some 40-some-odd miles behind the German line. Then the weather goes bad. This is the other thing as far as Murphy's Law. The weather starts to go bad about 4 or 5 days after, when some of the gliders were supposed to bring in reinforcing infantry. And so these had to be postponed. Then you're not able to resupply by air as well, because the Allied transport system is just taxed to the limit with this whole operation. And if we look at maybe even a little bit bigger picture, the real tragedy of this whole thing is that the key to the Allied supply problem was a city called Antwerp in Belgium, which is the greatest harbor in Northern Europe. The Allies had the city and the harbor facilities, but not the estuary that led to it. So it made Antwerp useless. By going forward with Market Garden, it diverted resources from the clearing out of the estuary, and thus you could not use Antwerp, and thus your supply situation remained problematic until Christmas time almost. So this whole thing is just a kind of a loser from a lot of different angles, unfortunately.
Tell us about the U.S. involvement of the clearing of the Scheldt estuary.
Yeah, this is something that happens, after Market Garden had been stalemated. I would say, I agree with most historians who look at it and say, within about a 1 week to 10-day period, Market Garden has clearly failed and it's leading toward a stalemate. And so you end up with this stalemate in Holland the rest of that fall of 1944, and airborne divisions that were designed to be shock troops end up serving, on the front line, almost not quite trench warfare, but static warfare, for the better part of 2 months. In the meantime, to their north, a multiple nation allied army has to clear out the Scheldt estuary in the rains of October and November, pouring down rain, mud, high water table, bad road net. And the Germans had had time to fortify the Scheldt estuary, and so they didn't need a whole lot of troops to hang on to this place. And they delay the Allies for 6 to 8 weeks. So the U.S. 104th Infantry Division, a unit called the Timberwolves, fights alongside Polish, British, and Canadian soldiers in what was a dirty job. But I think, to me, that's the sort of rest of the story of Market Garden, because they're interconnected. And so I include a pretty detailed chapter towards the end of the book about the experiences of the 104th there. And it gives you a sense of the consequences of Market Garden. And this is the 104th, too, one of the interesting things about it. It's a new unit. This is their first combat, yet they're under a very experienced commander, General Terry Allen, who commanded the famous 1st Infantry Division in the Mediterranean, and whom Patton and Bradley had fired because they felt that his troops were too rebellious and didn't have enough discipline. But Allen was too good to sit out the rest of the war. So his 104th has quite an introduction to combat in Holland, but they did very well.
You talk about The Last Stand, a drama of the Red Devils at Arnhem. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is one of the, from an Allied point of view, and certainly from a British point of view, this is one of the great tragedies of the whole war. The British 1st Airborne Division was nicknamed the Red Devils. It was a fine unit, and they had really the key mission of all of Market Garden, to go in at Arnhem and capture the key bridges over the Rhine so that the tanks could eventually go over the Rhine and get into northern Germany and go towards Berlin. Well, they end up cut off in Arnhem. They fight desperately for the bridge there. There's a stalemate there, but most of the division is cut off, and about two-thirds of it is lost. And, you end up, and I cover this in the book pretty extensively, the 82nd Airborne Division suffers massive casualties to get across the river at Nijmegen, which is about, 10-plus miles, 10 to 20 miles from Arnhem. You can almost see Arnhem on a clear day from Nijmegen. But they get in boats, they cross the river, they capture the key part of the road net, they keep the bridges intact, like a major highway road bridge that you need. And they expected British tanks would push on to Arnhem. Well, this is just a miscommunication, because the British tanks were in no position to do so. And so most of those Red Devils end up captured or killed up at Arnhem. About 3,000 to 4,000 of them were filtered and evacuated southward, hook up with American soldiers, and are saved. And some of the Polish brigade, too. There were about 800 Polish soldiers involved in this fighting as well, and they suffered heavy casualties.
Okay, we've got about 3 minutes to go, so I want to cover, what did Patton, okay, all this stuff is unfolding. What did he think about all of this thing?
Patton thought this was an absolute terrible mistake and fiasco. And, you know, of course, for the reasons we've outlined, but he felt that Eisenhower would have been much wiser to afford him the opportunity to redouble his operations around Metz, and that Patton could have then, you know, gone deeper into Germany. Well, you know, I don't think there's any question he would have had greater momentum. Now, this is just my opinion and hypothetical, of course, but I don't see why he would have ended up in any more of a fairy tale situation than Montgomery did. The Germans were going to counterattack. They were still powerful, and they were going to be in a position to really put serious issues on any kind of single thrust. So I tend to be a firm believer in the broad front strategy, and I think that's sort of the tragedy of this whole thing, is that the Allies probably could have done much more damage if they had secured the Scheldt estuary, thus using Antwerp, and everybody would have been better off supply-wise probably by the end of September and October. But, you know, of course, this is a study in massive frustration for George Patton, and he ends up bogged down in and around Metz throughout much of that fall of 1944, which is, I think, you know, kind of the nadir of his operational career in World War II. Most of the other times you're looking at him, he's doing some pretty amazing things. This is the low point, that sort of September to November period when his army is really bogged down.
You use personal accounts. Talk about the human condition. How did you get these people to respond to you?
Years of interviews, oral histories, great sources that that historians like the great Cornelius Ryan had gathered, you know, when he did research for his book, Bridge Too Far, and he had the foresight to hang on to the surveys he had veterans fill out in the 1960s and 70s, the operational records, letters that soldiers wrote, diaries they kept. I mean, there's just a rich vein of sources. So in the book, you know, I really bring to life the human story of so many Americans, from privates to generals, including most notably General James Gavin, the commander of the 82nd Airborne Division, who's fascinating. So that was one of the reasons why I did the book, is that what interests me is the everyday human story of soldiers. And I felt like I could really bring that to life because there were so many sources at my disposal.
Well, folks, that's September Hope. September Hope, the American Side of a Bridge Too Far. The author, John C. McManus. Let me spell that for you. Capital M, small c, capital M-A-N-U-S. He's also the author of Grunts. He's also the author of Alamo in the Ardennes. We've got about 1 minute. Real quick, tell us about Alamo in the Ardennes. Real quick.
Well, Alamo in the Ardennes looks at the later phase of the war during the Battle of the Bulge. And, of course, we're all familiar as Americans with the famous Siege of Bastogne, which is sort of in the nexus of the Bulge when the Germans attack in December 1944. But I think what gets lost sometimes is the race for the town, those first 2 to 3 to 4 chaotic days. And so the book is about soldiers from the 28th Infantry Division and some of the Armored Division soldiers who buy time for the paratroopers to get to Bastogne.
Okay.
And again, quite fascinating.
John, I want to thank you very much for being on the program. And we've got 10, 9, until next week. This is Bob Gould. Dale Throneberry will be with us. You are dismissed.